Digital Migration Podcast, fourth episode, ECRIS, TCN, and the Fundamental Rights of Third Country Nationals. Welcome to the Digital Migration Podcast, an initiative of the Line of Research on Migration and Digital Transformation of Nova Refugee Clinic Legal Clinic. Our group is composed by
Emily de Oliveira, Sofia Sulaiman, Inês Freire dos Santos,
Victoria Costa,
Priscila Azevedo, and I have the honor of chairing this episode, which will feature three distinguished guests. Balsamis Mitzlegas, Professor of European Criminal Law and Global Security, Director of the Criminal Justice Center, and since 2018, Deputy Dean of Global Engagement Europe at Queen Mary University of London. Petra Molnar, Associate Director of the Refugee Law Lab, based at York University Center of Refugee Studies and Osgoode Hall Law School of York University. She is also a lawyer and researcher at the Migration and Technology Monitor. And Chris Jones, Director of State Watch, where he has worked since 2010. He specializes in issues relating to policy, migration, privacy and data protection, and security technologies. Thank you all for having accepted our invitation and being here today with us. I would like to start with a question to Balsamis. In 2019, the European Parliament and Council adopted the regulation 2018-8016 to supplement the existing EU Criminal Records Database, ECRIS, by targeting third country nationals and stateless persons, the so-called ECRIS-TCN. It is expected that the integration test will begin in July this year and preparations for entry into operation in March next year. To contextualize our audience, could you please briefly explain what is the purpose of ECRIS-TCN and how this database will function? Could you also share your main concerns regarding the rights to privacy and data protection of third country nationals?
Thank you very much. Thank you for the kind invitation. It's a great pleasure for me to be with you today and to participate in this great initiative. There is a great need for further conversation on these issues. And I congratulate you on really having a whole session on something that is really very obscure. And even if you tell someone ECRIS-TCN, you know, they will look at you as if, you know, you were from the moon. So I will try to give a bit of context on ECRIS-TCN. So ECRIS is the European Criminal Records Information System and TCN is third country nationals. And I see it as another example of the securitization or the criminalization of migration in the European Union. We have seen one trend which has been growing over time, and I think you have already discussed in your podcasts, where you have immigration measures, including in particular immigration databases, being used for law enforcement purposes. So, for example, you know that the police now has access to databases such as the Visa Information System, Eurodac, and so on. These databases, just to remind the audience, are databases which are established for purely administrative purposes, and they do not involve criminal activity. But we have a spillover, if you like, of criminal law and security to immigration management. ECRIS-TCN is another example, but I think in the opposite direction, where we can see mechanisms involved for the management of criminal justice being extended to cover migrants. So ECRIS, the European Criminal Records Information System, is a system that has been established in order to enable the swift awareness, if you like, or exchange of information on whether an individual has a criminal record in EU member states. And ECRIS, as you know, is a decentralized network, so it's not a centralized EU database. And then we have this initiative, which I must say to me was quite a bit of a surprise when I saw it emerging, with the idea of extending it to third country nationals, but not only in the way that the traditional ECRIS was designed. So, you know, you could have a system where, you know, you also have the hit or no hit of of third country nationals, but we have a more centralized structure now where biometrics of third country nationals are included and where the system is not only linked to strictly criminal justice purposes. So, you know, so we have really, and I think it's important, I'm sure my colleagues will comment on that, you know, ECRIS-TCN may be used for immigration control purposes. It is a clear example of the merging between migration and security, because as we will discuss, and as you know, ECRIS-TCN is also part of the whole new EU framework on, and that's not an easy word to say, on interoperability. So it is now envisaged that the number of EU information systems are linked, regardless, if you like, of their purpose. And I was reading with interest while I was doing my homework for this podcast, because, you know, there are many developments here, that the one of the key uses of ECRIS-TCN will be for the operation of ETIAS, which is the electronic travel authorization system that the EU has established for pre-screening, if you like, for preventive control of passengers before they enter into the EU in terms of their those who are not in it of a visa. So, you know, this is really a securitized preventive mechanism. This is a system where the extension to third-country nationals is not necessarily justified from the perspective of the original conception of ECRIS, which is something very specific and very targeted, if you like, in the field of criminal law. And I think that the challenges are not only challenges, obviously, of privacy and data protection, because, you know, we have a lot of data, we have very deep data, you know, we have biometrics, you know, we may have all sorts of technologies employed really to check identities and records. But also a broader challenge, I think, for me, which is the preventive challenge of access to the territory in the first place for those who are not yet in the EU, if it's linked with interoperability. And also we'll discuss later what happens to those in the territory in terms of how the information is used in terms of their immigration status. And of course, we're going to talk about dual nationals, and there are serious issues about EU citizenship as well. I will stop here, but I'm looking forward to listening to my colleagues, who I'm sure will have much more detail on this.
Thank you. Petra, in your opinion, what is the main difference between the existing ECRIS database from ECRIS-TCN regarding data collection and storage? Do you consider this difference may affect the free movement rights of EU citizens with dual nationality and third country nationals?
Thanks so much for that question and for having me. As Valsami said, I think this is such an important conversation, and hopefully through this kind of granular look at this particular database, we'll also be able to kind of get at some of the animating policies and factors that I think are really leading to this kind of techno-solutionism that we're seeing at and around the border. Because I think really that's maybe where we need to start when we try and unpack how the ECRIS-TCN will be experienced by people who are on the move. Because we're really talking about this normalization of more data points, and it all really is leading towards this animating idea that Valsamis already introduced, this criminalization of migration. But I think as your question already sets out, it also talks about this kind of differentiation of experience, people who are EU citizens or who might be dual nationals and those who are third country nationals. Because that's, for me, one of the main concerns about this. It's the fundamental question around how can we ensure that this database as it currently exists aligns with principles of non-discrimination and equality? Because of course we know that third country nationals already are treated in differential ways in the EU. And for me, one of the main issues with this is also just a lot of opacity around how this will work. And I know that Chris will hopefully get into this as, you know, one of the experts really on this. This is a little bit outside of my zone of work, because I mostly look at kind of surveillance technology at the border, but it really made me think of some of the issues around just retention periods and things like that. We don't know necessarily what's going to happen with this data, where it will be, who will have access to, which other entities through the principle of interoperability or data sharing between different databases, how that will kind of impact folks who are on the move. And again, I think the issue here is that we're talking about a fundamental principle of differentiation that's at the center of how this was designed, right? We're talking about EU citizens versus third country nationals. And it, again, I think highlights this kind of normalization of difference that we really, really need to pick apart. And, you know, and I'll end here. I think, again, it's about fundamental ideas of which powerful entities get to collect information on whom and who can also opt out, right? Because we don't really know what some of those frameworks might look like, especially for third country nationals who have a right to enter the EU territory. But they might be kind of caught under this broad increasing umbrella of datification that we're talking about. So I'll leave it there, but I look forward to discussing more throughout the conversation.
Thank you, Petra. Chris, in your analysis published on the State Watch website under the title Disproportionate and Discriminatory, the European Criminal Records Information System for Third Country Nations, you mentioned that the establishment of a centralized database for the ECRIS-TCN is controversial because it runs counter the requirements for the authorities to employ the least intrusive option when infringing upon individuals' rights. From your perspective, how does the interoperability agenda of the EU policy and migration have influenced the shift from the decentralized to a centralized system?
Good question. I mean, I'll add to the chorus and just say congratulations on hosting a podcast on this particular topic. Quite obscure, but also important. I suppose it's worth going back maybe a bit to, well, Balsamis already mentioned the origins of this, which is in something called the European Criminal Records Information System. And the original arguments for this TCN addition were that because in the ECRIS, each member state acts as the home register for all the criminal records of people of that nationality. So if I'm a Polish person, I'm convicted in Greece, the Greek authorities have to send information on that conviction to the Polish authorities. And then if I'm arrested in Spain, the Spanish will say, well, you're Polish, we're going to ask the Polish authorities for information on all your previous convictions, and they'll have information on the conviction I received in Greece and any I received in Poland and so on. So it was this method of sharing information, but also creating a way to centralize it. But that only worked for EU citizens, because non-EU citizens obviously don't have a home member state to serve as their central register. This was deemed a problem because, you know, there may have been, I do not recall anyone providing any particularly overwhelming evidence about this, but there may have been, you know, non-EU nationals escaping the consequences of their acts against the law after being arrested for a second time or a third time or whatever it might be. So the argument then went, well, we need to find a way to, systematically obtain information on the previous convictions handed down in the European Union against non-EU nationals. And, you know, well, I mean, we could say as well, the necessity of this, obviously, like the original ECRIS, also rests, you know, your idea of the legitimacy of it also rests upon your thoughts about the legitimacy of the criminal justice system and the fact that there's massive over-criminalization of people in Europe for many reasons. Think about probably the war on drugs is the best example. Why do people end up in prison for non-violent crimes that don't really harm anyone else? That's a separate discussion. So let's just take that as a given. So the authorities decided, right, we need a way to store information on non-EU nationals. And the European Commission proposed a decentralized system. I forget the details of how this was supposed to work, but the point being, it would not require the storage of any information in a large central database. That's better in terms of security because there's less risk of it being hacked and the information getting leaked. And obviously this is particularly sensitive information about people's, you know, interactions with the criminal justice authorities. That's a major plus. It's also less intrusive than a centralized system, which involves, you know, the hoovering up of this information into one single place. And really, when you're introducing a measure that does infringe upon the rights to privacy, data protection, or any other rights, you're supposed to choose the least intrusive measure possible that allows you to achieve your goal. So this decentralized system, it was argued, was ideal for that because the information would have stayed dispersed throughout the member states, no central system, relatively cheap and technically possible. Then about a year and a half later, there'd obviously been some discussions, some political discussions about this proposal, and it was ditched. The idea was thrown aside and a new proposal was introduced for a centralized system, which is what we have now. That was justified on the grounds that it would be cheaper and less complex than a decentralized system, although the figures provided didn't really bear that out. In any case, you know, costs, well, it was a few million euros here and there. You could have done something much more useful with those few million euros. But, you know, if it was cheaper, it certainly wasn't by very much. They argued it wouldn't be any more intrusive for fundamental rights, which is precisely the opposite of what they argued when they said we should have a decentralized system. And as you mentioned in your question, they argued it would assist in the interoperability agenda. So in the proposal for this centralized system, the European Commission said, and I quote, the political stance regarding systematic use of fingerprints for secure identification and generally the attitude towards data sharing and security has changed. I.e., we think differently about this. We want more data. We want to share it. We want to intermingle it and process it in new ways. Therefore, we're going to build a giant centralized database which can interact with all these other databases we're building as part of this interoperability initiative. So really what you have is a situation where the tail is wagging the dog, the tail here being interoperability and that plan, which led to a change in, you know, what this system should be. And that really isn't the way you're supposed to make policy or law. You know, you have one overarching policy objective for interoperability of personal data and all these other databases and data sets you can use that you can make interoperable with this new system on convicted people. Well, that may be the case. You can do that, but that's not a legitimate justification for establishing a large new centralized database when there is a less intrusive option available for what you want to achieve. So, yeah, we don't, you know, there's a lot more discussions that take place than we ever see the records of or are privy to, but it's evident from the paper trail that exists that really this was a political decision to make this new system more, well, to make it a functional component of this interoperability plan.
Thank you. Valsamis, the regulation 2019-8016 that established the ECRIS TCN is the first union law instrument that treats union citizens who also hold a third country nationality as third country nationals. This is a controversial aspect and may lead to discrimination on the basis of nationality, racial, and ethnic origin, since the majority of union citizens with dual nationality are immigrants or children of immigrants. What are your considerations regarding this point? Do you agree that this regulation formalizes the creation of a second-class European citizens? Is it possible to say that a dangerous precedent of institutional discrimination would be set and other databases may follow suit?
Thank you for this question, which I think is spot on. And I think you mentioned already the risks in your question on that. What you can see here is the treatment of EU citizens as third country nationals. So, you know, you have dual nationality, but the EU component of that appears not to count at all. And so, you know, there are serious issues of equality and non-discrimination when you use, so not only, and we mentioned already the issues regarding third country nationals themselves, which is one set of rules, if you like, but there is also, of course, as you know, a very developed law and case law and EU acquis and constitutional framework with regard to the rights of EU citizens. And there, this proposal, this law actually is very, very problematic. And I'm not really sure whether it will survive a challenge before the Court of Justice of the European Union that would urge you as a law clinic, perhaps to find a way to challenge or to convince the Portuguese judges to send a question to Luxembourg on that, because, you know, it is really not it is not very plausible, I think, what has been proposed. And also, I think, practically and pragmatically, what you have, in a sense, you have the EU citizens who are subject to ECRIS, which is decentralized and contains a range of information, but not as intrusive. And then you have another category of EU citizens who happen to be third country nationals, who are subject to a different regime, a regime within a centralized system, and really with a much more invasive collection of personal data, and really also talking about interoperability, which I think is very important here, being treated really as people who do not have the right to be in the territory. So, you know, if you think about it, you know, so you're an EU citizen, but you know, your data is cross-checked and combined, and you're being profiled on the basis of immigration databases. So this is really not right, and I would also encourage the audience, if you have some time, to look at the very strong opinion of the Myers Committee, which is a committee with wonderful Dutch colleagues, both academics and practitioners, who have issued a very detailed opinion on exactly this point, the ECRIS-TCN and its compatibility with EU citizenship law. So, you know, and I think that I would agree with the points that the committee makes.
Thank you, Valsamis. Petra,
it strikes me we could sum up. Oh, sorry. I was going to add something, if I might.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But I think maybe we can sum up the problem Valsamis has just outlined, with that you now have the situation now is that all EU citizens are equal, but some are more equal than others, to paraphrase George Orwell. I.e. those who don't, you know, who aren't also citizens of another country have more from the EU country.
Thank you, Chris. Petra, in the technological testing ground report, in order to avoid that automated decision-making process under the interoperability regime put human rights at risk, you recommended the establishment of an independent body to oversee and review all use of the existing and proposed automated technologies in migration management, including by EU-funded entities such as Frontex and Europol. Would it be possible to apply this idea to a database like ECRIS TCN version? If so, how would you imagine such monitoring?
Thanks so much for this question. I mean, I think, again, it gets a really fundamental idea that all of us are trying to pick apart in this migration management regime. And that's a lack of clarity around A, what's happening, and then B, what to do about it. And, you know, when we wrote our report back in 2020 now, one of the recommendations, as you said, was to call for an independent oversight mechanism of a lot of these technologies, both around the stuff that actually happens at the border, but also when it comes to the interoperability and the what some people call the datification of migration management. That's one of the ways to do it, for sure, to try and call for another body, another independent mechanism, to ensure, again, that rights are respected, both in terms of the data protection privacy angle, but also non-discrimination, equality, and a host of other fundamental rights that are impacted. But actually, you know, it's also, I think, important to stretch the conversation further and actually ask, are there areas of datification technology at the border that we are just not okay with? And perhaps oversight and monitoring is just not enough. Maybe what we do need at this point is a moratorium or some red lines until and unless we have a strict governance mechanism in play. And I don't want to get too ahead of myself. I know one of the other questions that's coming up might also touch on this, but I think the AI Act, the proposed AI Act that the European Union is currently thinking through, is a really instructive piece of potential governance mechanism here, because of course it's far from perfect. And many of us on this call actually have raised some really significant issues, and I would urge you to check out Statewatch's amazing report on the AI Act. But what is interesting is that I think regionally speaking, the EU is thinking about how to regulate something as kind of amorphous and difficult to define as AI and automation in migration, but also in all sorts of other use cases. But you know, those of us who really try and push the EU forward, I think we make arguments that actually it also doesn't go far enough, that we really need to think about how is this technology experienced? What is it doing on the ground? And what kind of safeguards and oversight mechanisms do we actually need before this should be rolled out? But it's one of those conversations, I think, that's quite frustrating for a lot of us in this space, because oftentimes the proponents of the tech make it seem like it's inevitable. Like, you know, the train has already left the station. We now have to just think about governance, regulation, oversight, and all of that, rather than actually having some of those foundational conversations about what are we okay with as a society? Are we okay with creating a differential system that treats third country nationals differently than EU citizens? I mean, given the way that the EU migration policies have historically been, I think the answer is yes, we are in fact okay with a differentiated approach to many things. But I don't think that's actually something that we should still not be fighting for. You know, a much fairer system where fundamental rights are actually at the center of it. And also people's experiences when it comes to this tech. I think we have a lot more work to do. And currently, we are just playing catch up with the kind of governance and regulatory conversations and oversight conversations that we should have been having 5-10 years ago. So, you know, I think it's a really important piece to the puzzle here. But I think it also highlights this rather full on appetite for more data, more interoperable databases, more automation at the border. And unfortunately, you know, the governance and regulatory ideas and conversations are playing catch up a little bit with what we're seeing in reality.
Thank you, Petra. Chris, also in your analysis, you mentioned that the inclusion of dual nationals in the database cannot prevent them from hiding behind one of their nationalities, which was a fear of the Council and the Commission. So an access facility was therefore created. Could you please explain to our audience how it would work and possible implications regarding fundamental rights?
Yes, I can try. Because I was doing my homework for this this podcast and read about this again and thought, ooh, it's a bit mind-boggling. So what happened was the whole issue of dual nationals being included in this database was a subject of the negotiations between the Parliament and the Council, and the Parliament was originally opposed outright to including dual nationals in this database, precisely because of the reasons we've outlined, that it creates, you know, two tiers of EU citizenship, and there wasn't really any justification for this differential treatment. Some point in the negotiations, which, you know, as your listeners may know, take place in secret, in these meetings called trilogues, where you have the Parliament, the Council, and the European Commission sitting there talking about things behind closed doors with, well, in secret, which is not really how laws are meant to be made in a democracy. But at some point during those negotiations, the Parliament gave up on its position that dual nationals shouldn't be included in the system. And they said, okay, fine, you can include them in this ECRIS TCN database. But in that case, you're not allowed to put their fingerprints in there. And this was what they settled on in the end. You know, the Council, the Parliament, and the Commission, they said, fine, we want to have the dual nationals, but if for the Parliament the condition is then we can't store their fingerprints, then okay. Now, I don't really see what practical difference that makes, because you've already, you know, the principle of the matter is you shouldn't have these people in this system. You've already breached that, and all you've done is then just minimize the kinds of information you hold on them. But that's the agreement they made. The Commission was very upset about this and actually issued a statement after the law was negotiated, saying, well, we think this is a very bad idea and they should have included fingerprints in this for dual nationals. So but that was the compromise they made. And for that reason, there's a provision in the law which says for the purpose of criminal proceedings or, you know, giving licenses or permits or security clearances or employment vetting for visa, asylum, migration procedures, the authorities can search in the ECRIS TCN to see whether, regarding a citizen of the EU, there is also any information in there about that person as a third country national. So the idea here is there might be people who actually do have two nationalities, but they're not telling the authorities about it because they're trying to hide their criminal past where they were convicted as, I don't know, someone from the Russia or the Dominican Republic or wherever it might be. Now, on a practical level, I'm not sure how that works if you don't have the fingerprints of these people, because their name is maybe the same. It might be different. They might have a different name, or it might be spelt differently. It might be in a different alphabet. But the real fundamental point is who is likely to be suspected of having another nationality. You know, undoubtedly that suspicion is going to fall more heavily upon non-white EU citizens or ethnic minorities, because the way the authorities, you know, it's the way our society works, is people who do not look ethnically European are, you know, deemed to have some sort of connection to a foreign country, and therefore these people are likely to be more subject to a greater level of suspicion, and then intrusion into their rights. You know, their personal data is going to be processed, they're going to be questioned more about these things than would someone who probably than someone who, you know, has white skin and is deemed to be more ethnically European. So that's how this sort of access facility works. It came about as a way to deal with this compromise that was made in the text, and really doesn't do anything to you know, deal with the fundamental problem of discriminating against dual nationals. If anything, it, you know, might well make it worse.
Thank you so much. Our members also have some questions. Emily?
Yes, I do. I do have a question to Valsamis. In the article, "The European Union and Preventive Injustice, the Legacy of the War on Terror," you mentioned that starting with response to 9/11, counterterrorism efforts have acted as a catalyst for the furthering of European integration in the field of security. And these developments reflect a preventive security agenda premised on the maximum connection and exchange of personal data. How can the shift of preventive justice and expansion of the use of the criminal law database, ICRIS, be used for border control purposes? Do you think the replacement of presumption of innocence for a presumption of potential dangerousness is the next level of the so-called criminalization of migration?
Thank you for this question, and I like your phrase, from the presumption of innocence to the presumption of dangerousness, in a sense. And I think that's a lot of what's been happening through a number of threads, and we've discussed it already, I think, more broadly about the securitization and criminalization of migration being one aspect of this, a trend towards anticipating the future. That's not the only element, but for the purpose of our discussion today, I think that the move to what governments now call border security, I think, is part of this. So, and I think for ECRIS TCN, what was interesting to me when I was reading the contributions and the documents is that, yes, on the one hand, we have what is happening within the territory of the EU, and Chris mentioned this in great detail, I think, and very eloquently, what happens to a dual national or to a third country national who is already within the EU, and the possibilities really of targeting of discrimination and so on and so forth there. But also, I think because that's part of the general system of EU databases, and we talked about interoperability, you know, this also obtains a preventive dimension, because these databases may be consulted in the context, in conjunction with more directly, if you like, EU preventive databases. And I mentioned already ETIAS, you know, which is the travel authorization, but also, of course, the visa information system, you know, which is another system where, which is really a preventive, if you like, immigration database, where, you know, the point is to check before entry or before the beginning of travel and so on and so forth. So, you know, so there is a contribution to that. My point also that everybody has raised today is important, I think, for the audience to reflect on how everything is sort of interconnected. I mean, Chris mentioned that the Commission's justification that it's all about data. So it's all about data on the one hand, it's all about security on the other. And then Petra mentioned the technology and the automaticity of this. One of my concerns, I think, with this from a rule of law perspective, and I mentioned something, and thank you for mentioning this brief blog post on Verfassung's blog, is that for technology, for example, and for databases, I think you see authorities really using technology in a way as an effort to neutralize democratic control and scrutiny and also legal scrutiny. So since the beginning, I think in 15 years ago when the Commission proposed first interoperability, the Commission already then stated that this is not a legal concept. You know, it's just a technical concept, and interoperability will not have any impact whatsoever, which begs the question, why do you do this in the first place? So, you know, the Commission's argument is that there are no data protection implications because, you know, it's all existing data. And of course, this is not correct. It cannot be correct. You know, the outcomes are really, you know, massively important. And that's something also that the European Data Protection Supervisor has said. So, you know, so my concern is also a rule of law concern there. It is that we accept technology as inevitable, and we create mechanisms which cannot really be controlled anymore, or we are told that they should not be controlled because it's all about the technology. You know, there are no legal issues there in a sense. So, you know, so I think we need to be very vigilant about this. And I think both Petra and Chris have been really very proactive and leading the way on greater accountability. But it's not only about accountability in the exposed sense, as Petra mentioned, it's also that we need to see what is going on really. I mean, you mentioned opacity, for example. I mean, what happens if you are caught into that? It's quite, I will not use the word Orwellian, it's very trendy, but maybe Kafkaesque as well, that you know, you do not really know what is happening with this information, how is it combined, who has access to this, and what is the outcome for the individuals who are affected. So, you know, and it's very, very difficult for this to be challenged in court. It's an area where it is very problematic, and this is why a lot of solutions have come, as Petra said, from suggesting greater oversight, but I agree with Petra that oversight by itself is not enough here. I think that we really need to open our eyes, really, and to be much, much more proactive and to check the limits to these systems as such. I know I've spoken too much, but one more sentence on that. Look at the EU architecture on this. Who controls this? It's a body called EULISA. I don't know whether you would have a discussion in EULISA. I would recommend, if you haven't done so already, to have this. So what the EU is doing is that, oh, the accountability will come from another EU agency, which is also framed as a technical agency. So really with the very limited fundamental rights responsibilities, in a sense. So EULISA will be there to make sure that everything functions properly. So and I would caution against this approach.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your answer. I don't know if Petro, Chris would like also to join this question. Not for now. Okay, so let me just ask a question that was asked by Sofia Solaiman. She could not join us today, but she let her question to Petra. In your article, New Technologies in Migration, Human Rights Impacts, you defend that states are keen to explore the use of new technologies in migration management, yet greater oversight and accountability mechanisms are needed in order to safeguard fundamental rights. I'd like to ask you, what mechanism do you think that would be effective to safeguard fundamental rights? Thank you.
Thanks for that question. Yeah, I'm going to go a bit philosophical here first, because I think it's actually important to really look at it from a broader perspective, because as we've been discussing this entire hour, accountability and oversight mechanisms only really get us so far. Because at the end of the day, you know, yes, we're talking about technology, we're talking about new tools, automation, interoperability, all these big terms, but really what we're talking about is power and differential power between different entities. And the fact that we're also all working with communities that have historically been marginalized and re-marginalized in conversations and also in the kind of way that proposed innovations are put on the table. So if we really want to have a conversation that centers human rights and fundamental rights, we really need to zoom out and ask, like, what is it really doing? Who gets to participate in conversations around what we innovate on and why? Why are particular groups constantly tested upon? And this goes beyond migration, of course. We're talking about, you know, seeing really similar trends in criminal justice and predictive policing, welfare algorithms, biometrics in refugee camps. I mean, people would be up in arms if all of a sudden you went to your local grocery store and had to give an iris scan in order to get in. And yet this is normalized in refugee camps and in sites of humanitarian emergencies. Why is that? Well, it's because there is a differential of power and who can opt out, who has access to certain rights and remedies and all of that. So yes, we need more oversight. Yes, we need more accountability. But we actually need to zoom out and ask, you know, what is it really doing? What kind of world are we building? And who's actually involved in the kind of conversations? Because, you know, and you so keenly quote from this brief article that I wrote, you know, I think there is this animating idea, this AI arms race, that some people have called it, or this turn to techno-solutionism that states in particular are really, really gunning for and pushing for. But really, this is the foundational idea here is that migration is something to be managed and controlled. And some people are presupposed to be threats and dangerous until proven otherwise. I mean, these are foundational ideas in migration and refugee law already. And again, these power differentials are just exacerbated by the way that we are automating different facets of the border and immigration regime. There's also a lot of hubris in this, right? We're all of a sudden turning to all sorts of tech solutions without actually thinking through why people might be forced to move in the first place, why they are making dangerous journeys, why they're reuniting with people across different borders. I mean, we all live really complex lives, and yet we've kind of been reduced into these kind of solutions or something to be managed, you know? So at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, there are mechanisms I think that we can all push for, but also certain red lines and certain really strong stances that we can take, because we desperately need to think about the kind of knock-on effects and ramifications that tech has. And I'll just end with one more idea. I mean, it's also about centering the people who are really at the sharpest edges of the tech. So not just lawyers, not just academics, not just civil society, but also the groups that are actually the ones who are oftentimes experiencing the most dire effects of this tech. We really all collectively as a space need to do more to ensure that these are the voices, these are the experiences that are leading the conversation.
Thank you, Petra. I have a question for Chris. So as you referred in your article, automated suspicion, the EU new travel surveillance initiatives, how do you think we could draw a line as to what the definition of a potential criminal is? I know you've said before, suspicion usually lies upon non-looking EU citizens, but how do you think we could accurately regulate law enforcement access to personal data of these individuals? And also, what do you think, what do you mean by persons who are wanted by discrete checks? And to what extent do you support this idea?
Yeah, I guess there's two kind of different things there. So the first one, I mean, kind of follows on from what Alsamis and Petra have just been saying, this idea of preventative knowledge and preventative security, which really is very much bound up with this idea that technology can solve all our problems. And you see this elsewhere. Like if you look at the debate about climate change, you know, there is a group or a class of people who are very heavily invested in the way the fossil fuel economy works. They're not interested in changing that in any fundamental sense. So they say, well, why don't we build machines that can suck carbon out of the air? Now, the analog in the world of security and policing is you have states that and organizations that are very heavily invested in economic and social models that lead to things like you know, large-scale migration. You have, I suppose, the most obvious example, Europe and its many of its former colonies are massively unequally developed because Europeans spent hundreds of years extracting resources and wealth from them. And you know, what you see now with people wanting to move to Europe, where that money has ended up is they would like to come here and, you know, share something. There was a slogan of I think it was the Asian youth movement in Britain, and they used to say, we're here because you were there. Now, the people in charge don't generally want to deal with like the fundamental underlying problems of this. So instead, you have this technological solutionism imposed on top, which comes tied up with this often very hostile xenophobic attitude towards people from other countries, which presumes that they're all some sort of potential threat. So you get these ideas about preventative security and, you know, what they don't really like to call, say, profiling so much anymore. They like to use the word screening. So where do we draw the line as to what the definition of a potential criminal is? I mean, undoubtedly there are people who are dangerous, and you know, society needs mechanisms to deal with those people. But sort of the approach we have at the minute seems to be put blanket suspicion over everybody who falls into a certain category, in this case foreign nationals, and as has already been said, you know, guilty until proven innocent, which, you know, turns the whole conception of liberal democracies on their heads, to bring it back to a more philosophical point. We're supposed to be, you know, free citizens or free individuals who are allowed to go about our business until we do something that leads us to bump up against the law or administration. And this goes the other way around. You know, you need to demonstrate, usually through some sort of trawling of your data, that you are a trustworthy individual. Whereas that's supposed to be the assumption in the first place, until proven otherwise. Then on the point about discrete checks, yes, well, this relates to another EU database, which is the Schengen Information System, which is the world's largest, I think, law enforcement database. It has millions and millions and millions of items and objects and people listed in it. And one of the things that the authorities are allowed to do with this system is they're allowed to flag people for what are called discrete checks. So there's three different kinds of sort of discrete checks. I believe discrete check is the one where the person you come across as a law enforcement official is not supposed to know you are investigating them somehow, but you're then supposed to record, you know, where they were encountered, who they were with, what they were carrying, where they were going. You know, you're supposed to gather as much information about them as possible without them realizing that you are gathering information about them. That's why it's discrete. And I mean, this, you know, this has always been possible. The use of these kinds of checks has accelerated a lot in the last 5, 6, 7 years, primarily as a result of the whole issue of people going to fight for ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and very heavily propelled by the French government. I mean, they are responsible for the majority of these kind of alerts in the Schengen information system. So now they're trying to find ways that they're more widely used. And you know, fine, there's some people who probably warrant being the subject of some sort of surveillance or suspicion, but the question is, how, you know, how far is it going to go? And fundamentally, do the authorities want to deal with the underlying causes of these things? You know, the French have been having their own little war against terror. Well, I say little war against terror in the Sahel for the last 6, 7, 8 years. They recently pulled out of, which by all accounts was a total failure, which will probably be the cause of more people, you know, wanting to do harm to people living in Europe and elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it is what it is. These things exist. The question is, I guess, are we looking for a way to get out of this kind of spiral of, violence and data gathering and suspicion and surveillance, or are the people who are responsible for these, you know, these data systems also responsible for, in many ways, for the underlying causes of them or the underlying justifications for them? And the question really is, what are we going to do about that?
Thank you.
Thank you. Before closing our episode, I would like to ask our guests if you would like to share with our audience any project or research you are involved in or developing, which will certainly be of interest of all of us to follow. Balsamis?
Thank you. There is always a lot to follow in this field. What I would say for those of you who are in Portugal is that I will be in Coimbra next week. So on the 8th of June in the afternoon, the Juridical Institute of the University of Coimbra is organizing a seminar. So I'm going to talk about the state of prevention. So much along our conversation today, but also focused more broadly on security. So it would be very nice to see you there if you can make the time, and perhaps your listeners might be interested as well. So, but thank you very much for the invitation. It has been really a great conversation. Congratulations on this initiative.
Thank you. Petra?
Wow, I wish I could come to Portugal too, hopefully one day. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I think for those of you who are interested in more global linkages at the Refugee Law Lab and with some other colleagues, you know, we're really trying to think of strategic ways to link the work that's being done in the EU with work, let's say, at the US-Mexico border, but then also further afield into Latin America, into the Middle East and North Africa region, and even Sub-Saharan Africa. So in the coming year or two, we really are trying to think through how best to link up and actually work collectively. So there'll be lots of opportunities to collaborate. And even though I feel shy doing this, I do want to just mention I am finishing a book that's hopefully going to be of interest. It's not an academic text. It's more of a kind of a deep dive of a lot of the techno-solutionism that we've been seeing at borders. And I've been, you know, trying to track this for about 5 years now. So it's slowly killing me putting this book together, but it should be done soon. So stay tuned for that. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Chris?
I suppose I would just say, I mean, we're working on a few different projects, but if your listeners found this subject interesting, then follow all the work Statewatch does, because you will definitely find some of it interesting. You can go on our website, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we have a mailing list, so you can follow all our work through those means. And yeah, hopefully you'll find things that stimulate your mind and make you aware of some of the things that our superiors are up to. And yeah, thanks for having me. Very, very nice conversation. So thanks for organizing it. Thanks for the invite.
Thank you. And now we come to the end of our episode. Thanks again for the brilliant and insightful participation of our guests, Balsamis, Petra, and Chris. To our followers, thank you for listening. And stay tuned for upcoming episodes, following us on social media and Nova Refugee Clinic website. Thank you. Bye.